Right, let's get stuck into the latest RHI inquiry. The newsletter's political editor, Sam McBride, has been torturing me for one of our special RHI jumpers with Dame Una and Keith MacLean and Sir Patrick on it. But Sam, you're not getting one.
I was hoping you weren't going to raise that as an issue, Stephen. I certainly, if someone's been torturing you, they've been doing it on my behalf. It certainly hasn't been me.
Well, now, your secret's out, Sam, but you're not getting one. Therefore, our listeners will be giving more away very soon. We've ordered one for you, Sam. We will send it. You're getting a Christmas present from The Nolan Show, given your dedicated coverage on this programme. Very interesting stuff in the RHI inquiry. Tell me, Sam, about the missing email, first of all.
Yes, this is an email which emerged last week. This is an email between two DUP spads. It was sent by Timothy Kearns, who was a special advisor to Jonathan Bell. It was sent to Timothy Johnston, who was the key DUP spad to the First Minister at that point. And this was at the point where the scheme was running out of control in August 2015. And really what this email did was it really quite significantly undermined the story which Timothy Johnston had told the inquiry and had told the public prior to the inquiry, that really he had no role whatsoever in that period in RHI. He was rejecting the evidence of Timothy Kearns that there had been a meeting between them where he had set up a process which led to Mr. Kearns working with Dr. Andrew Crawford, that's Arlene Foster's former advisor, in a process which we now know led to the delay of cost controls, regardless of whether that was intended or not. That is clearly what happened out of that process. What emerged last week from this email, which really was given to the inquiry by Mr. Kearns at the very last hour, very late the previous night, this shows that there was contact between Mr. Johnston and Mr. Kearns about RHI. It also shows that that contact was potentially quite significant, because even though this was a brief email, it was an email which alluded to deviating from what was happening in the rest of the UK with RHI. It talked about the potential for a ministerial direction. That's a really nuclear option within Stormont. It's not the sort of thing which is bandied about regularly. And therefore, that was something which led to considerable scrutiny at the inquiry of what this might mean. And Mr. Johnston said that he probably did read it, but he didn't remember it. He said it didn't really jog his memory, even seeing it at this point. But now we really are no further forward in terms of understanding how it is that this has come in at such a late point in the process.
So this was the main point within that email, Sam, was what? The most interesting point within that email was what?
I think that there were two points. First of all, the point that it was sent proves that there was contact between these two men about RHI. So that in itself is very significant.
Yeah, I get that. But in terms of the content of the email,
the key sentence in it said, from Mr. Kearns to Mr. Johnston, we also need to get a catch up on renewable heat. If we are to deviate from GB policy, it will require a ministerial direction. Now, what the inquiry was putting to Mr. Johnston last week was that is quite a cryptic reference to something. It's a very complex area of policy. You're talking about a ministerial direction, the sort of thing which would require a lot of explanation. You would think if there had not been some prior process where these two men had been discussing this and it made sense. Now, that's something Mr. Johnston said did not happen. He stuck to that position very rigorously at the inquiry last week.
And so am I right here, Sam? And it's an open question. So is it Timothy Johnston's position then that while he might have read that email, that an email saying that, look, we might have to deviate from GB policy, that Timothy Johnston, one of the most senior advisors in the DUP, looked at it, there's something talking about deviating from GB policy, and he just carried on with his day?
That is roughly his evidence. He says that this was a very busy period. He said that there was a lot going on. There was a lot of focus on another big green energy scheme, which was in much deeper trouble, it seemed to him at the time anyway, at that point, and that was what he was focused on. And really, he said that he thinks maybe that Mr. Kearns assumed that he had more knowledge of RHI than was actually the case. So that is really the direct conflict of evidence between these two key figures.
Here's what I find just as interesting. The inquiry has asked everyone that's been deemed to be a witness or who they've contacted many months ago to submit any evidence that might be of interest to the inquiry. How come that email has only appeared now? Where did it come from and why was it not handed in months ago?
Well, we know the answer to one of those questions, but we don't know the answer to the other. So it came from Timothy Kearns. It was handed over by his lawyer to the inquiry. inquiry late on the evening before Mr. Johnston was giving evidence last week at the inquiry. What we don't know is any sort of explanation for why that was the case. So we haven't seen a statement to the inquiry from Mr. Kearns explaining that. We haven't seen, we've heard it being put to Mr. Johnston. He says he has no recollection of this whatsoever. I asked some questions of both Mr. Kearns and Mr. Johnston because they have now finished their evidence, so we're able to ask them questions about this. And they both declined to answer. Mr. Kearns said that was on the advice of his solicitor. I asked the question of the DUP rather than Mr. Johnston because it's more, I think, a matter for the DUP who were asked to hand over all of the emails in their possession. The key thing here, I think, potentially, is that these emails seem to be from, the email seems to be from the evidence that has been published by the inquiry, that they have now published this email. It was held on a DUP server. And that might sound quite technical, but it's very important because it means that it was not held by the Stormont Department. They were not using departmental email addresses. This was off the system, if you like, and it was held by the DUP. Now, one of the questions that I asked the DUP was, is it still held by the DUP? Did you have this? Did you search for it? Did you not find it? And if you didn't find it, potentially, would that mean that there are other emails that might be relevant that weren't found? That's not something that's entirely clear yet, but I think that some people looking at this initially glanced at it and thought Tim Kearns here is being quite Machiavellian. He has held this back. He's putting it in at the last minute to try to unsettle a witness. He clearly has evidence that conflicts with his own. I think actually when you look at this in a little bit more detail, that might not be the case. And one of the reasons for believing that might not be the case is that Mr. Johnston was initially up for one day of evidence. This was actually handed in just before his second day of evidence. So there would have been no way for Mr. Kearns or Mr. Johnston, for that matter, to have known that he was going to overrun in that way.
I think, Sam, the obvious question is that if this email has just been handed in at the last minute, what other DUP emails on a DUP server haven't been handed to the inquiry? It's at least an obvious question. Are there any more?
It is, and I think the crucial issue here, and one of the reasons why it is so important when we get into questions, as we might later when we're talking about the evidence yesterday, about people using things like private email accounts to do government business, it's so important because it gives control of the information not to the government, not to the civil service. It gives control of the information to either a political party or an individual. In this case, it seems to be a political party. We don't know whether that information is still held. We don't know whether Mr. Kearns found a printout of this. We just don't have an explanation for that, but there are lots of questions certainly that spring to mind there.
Yeah, and let's get into what you're pushing us towards, because Dr. Andrew McCormick was back. He was another very senior civil servant. He was back in front of the inquiry again. And he said that officials were, quote, in a culture of very limited record keeping. And he accepts personal responsibility as the top civil servant at Detty at the time. This is a further insight, isn't it, into the workings of devolution in Northern Ireland, Sam. Dr. McCormick suggested that the realpolitik, I think as he put it, was that rules were routinely broken to get things done. He referred to Stormont as being a very young set of institutions with unique challenges. And he said that the behaviour which became normal, such as failing to keep basic records, was not a cause for blame, but that 10 years is a very short time in terms of organisational behaviour. Let's have a listen. This is quite long, but I think it's really interesting. Let's have a listen to some of Andrew McCormick's testimony to the RHI inquiry.
I think this is much more of a problem in devolved government, partly because, unlike Whitehall, it hasn't had, decades, centuries to establish norms and behaviours that are deeply within the culture. It's a very young set of institutions, and the tensions are multidimensional in the nature of enforced coalition, the nature of a power sharing arrangement, and where access to information is at a premium. And part of the concern of the smaller parties every time they've been in government is that the larger parties that supplied, both in the first assembly when UUP and SDLP were in charge, and more recently with DUP and Sinn Féin, the smaller parties always feel they're getting second class access to information, and part of the consequence of that has been a pattern of leaking. So, tweeting from the executive room when, in theory, the executive room is a space for private, and confidential government business to be done. That was what was happening. I mean, we had this very discussion with the Information Commissioner recently, and was making these points that this is part of how things are. There are lessons to be learned, ways to ensure there can be safe space for government. So I'm not saying that FOI or the approach of open government stands in the way of safe space. It doesn't. There is room if people observe the principles and respect each other to have frank and straightforward discussions. But the behaviours in the devolved context were just difficult, and I don't think that's a source of a cause for blame. That's simply a culture that is new, not settled. 10 years is a very short time in terms of organisational behaviour. I think it needs more of a chance to settle and establish a mature way of working.
10 years is quite a significant time, I would have thought. You've used the phrase tweeting from the executive chamber. Mm. Now, I can understand how leaking might occur if there is a written record. What's tweeting
so,
from
so,
the...
Either of...
Is that tweeted? Am I right in thinking that is somebody using social media to pass on information about an active debate that's taking place? Why wasn't there a proper disciplinary procedure in force for that?
So,
it's not the media's fault.
No, it's not. I'm heading into quite deep political territory here. But my personal view of that is that there are rules, but the nature of our institutions makes them quite difficult to enforce. Because
in what way?
Because of the very careful set of checks and balances within the Good Friday Agreement. That mean that there's achieving censure against someone who offends is actually quite difficult, both technically in terms of the way the checks and balances work, and more importantly politically. So excluding a minister for a breach of the ministerial code is they've happened time and again, but actually to enforce the rules is politically very difficult. And again, I think that's part of their need to work out a mature way of working, which 10 years, in that context, I stand my view that 10 years is quite a short time.
Well, I'm not sure how I don't want to go into territory that really isn't relevant to the inquiry, but from my own point of view, your suggestion that the Good Friday Agreement inhibits the quite proper disciplinary conduct of the proceedings to prevent unpermitted contact with the press or with outside, I think not only for me, but I would imagine for the vast majority of the population, would come as something of a shock.
The agreement and the ministerial code and all those things say all the right things about things that should not happen. What the realpolitik is that they're almost impossible to enforce. And therefore, they're not enforced and haven't been enforced.
But that isn't—I take it—that isn't the responsibility of the civil service, or it is.
No, it isn't.
It isn't. It's the responsibility of the political parties.
Up to them to work out a way of working, and that's what I think they clearly were trying to find that way of working. It's part of why DUP and Sinn Féin worked out ways to solve problems privately, and I think Timothy Johnson said here that there are. Those who committed to making these institutions work carried a very heavy burden, and I think that's highly, very, very important that people like him, like Aidan McAteer, who really tried very hard to make these things work and get past these problems, which but then there's a range of behaviours that work against it.
Well, it may I can understand why you're prepared to give credit to those who operate on a real politic basis, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
But by doing that, they are ensuring that the rules and the regulations, just as the code for SPADs, are completely ignored. And there cannot be, from a public point of view, a positive perception of the political process if that occurs. I would have thought.
I think what I'm saying is that they were trying to work towards adherence, compliance, and good behaviour, necessarily at times behind closed doors, necessarily at times with officials excluded, and consequentially with some aspects not recorded. That's part of the reality of our politics. But all of us who are trying to make these institutions work need to be realistic about that, determined and persistent in seeking to establish good practice, but recognising that the
I fully appreciate what you say, Dr. McCormick, but you either have rules or you don't have rules. You either have public documents or you don't have public documents. You either put the behaviour that you are encouraging into a public document and a code, or you don't.
Well, Sam, just as I'm listening to that, so essentially what Andrew McCormick is saying, and to be fair to him, others have said it too, is that the realpolitik of Northern Ireland, it was that the rules that were there to make sure that things were done properly and that there is integrity in the political system, when they wanted to break the rules behind the scenes, the politicians, not Dr. McCormick, the politicians, they did. They just went ahead and they decided that they were God. They could break the rules because the public would never find out. That's essentially what we're learning, isn't it?
That is, and it's a pretty unedifying picture, and Sir Patrick clearly was less than impressed with it, as you heard in that clip there. I mean, Andrew McCormick is somebody who's one of, if not the most experienced senior civil servant in Stormont. He's somebody who's widely, I think it's fair to say, regarded as a very honourable man, and I think he has showed that in many ways yesterday by accepting personal responsibility for really the shambolic state of aspects of his department and what happened on his watch. But the impression really that you got from that evidence and from other of his evidence yesterday was that really he had at the very least turned a blind eye to what he knew was bad behaviour, because essentially, I mean, he used the word realpolitik, which has come up any number of times to justify this during the inquiry. But really what he was saying was the end justified the means. This was necessary to keep Stormont on the road. That's what we wanted to do. And we let this happen.
And in terms of not keeping proper records and deliberately not writing things down, I think we probably need to not presume the public has full knowledge of how it actually works, Sam, that you and I knew, in that quite often when you put a Freedom of Information request into some of these departments, and I'm not specifying any department or about any issue here, I'm talking just generally, you and I would both have experience, Sam, of how when the system doesn't want to release information after a genuine FOI request, well, I can talk for myself, they leave it to the last minute before getting back to you because they've got a window. The law says that they've got a window within which they have to reply to you. Then sometimes they will come back to a journalist. Remember, a journalist is trying to put information into the public domain on behalf of the public. And then they try to buy more time, and then they sometimes try to come up with excuses as to why they won't give it to you when in the balance of probabilities you're thinking to yourself, really? Really, it's in the public interest for you to withhold that? Now, that's the freedom of information game, if you like. But what they were actually doing, the public shouldn't be in any doubt about this, what your government in Northern Ireland were doing was that they were deliberately not writing things down in case you, the public, ever found out. And the civil servants, who are supposed to be absolutely impartial, should be resisting any political pressure, should be sticking to the rules. They were complicit in agreeing not to write things down as well, in case you, the public, found out. Which begs the question, what were the secrets? What was going on in our government that they didn't want you, the public, to know? Now, is any of that unfair, Sam?
No, I think that is entirely fair. We knew anybody who has covered Stormont as a journalist or who has interacted with Stormont, whether from business or from other spheres of life, knows that Stormont was a very secretive place over the last decade. They did not like to let things out, even pretty mundane things. But let's not forget why it's important to write things down. This is not just about the good administration of public funds. This is not just about being able to run a very complex organisation efficiently. This is about trying to stop corruption, trying to stop the worst of human behaviour. And if you do not have those basic checks, as we're now finding, it's very, very difficult to prove if somebody acted in a proper fashion or if they acted in an improper fashion. And what the civil service seem to have done is that rather than take the view that the minister was there with a democratic mandate and the SPAD was there on his or her behalf with a democratic mandate to implement policy, what they had put to the people at an election, they seem to have taken the view that they were there with a mandate to really implement rule-breaking, that it wasn't just that they were there to put through laws, to make changes democratically, but that they had a mandate that somehow meant that they could ride over all of these regulations and rules. I mean, it's very difficult to understand how they justified that to themselves.
So in other words, the civil service, rather than side with the public and insist in sticking to the rules that were there to protect us, write it down, adhere to the rules, they sided with the politicians.
That's a very fair way of putting it. And the role of the civil service is to be absolutely impartial. They're not supposed to take sides, and there's no real suggestion that they were taking sides here. But I think the role is not just to be so anodyne, if you like, that you don't say anything. The role is to remind the minister and the department. And, of course, let's not forget that this was a system without an opposition for almost all of the last decade. There was very, very little scrutiny. Of almost every MLA was in a government party. So what little scrutiny we thought there maybe was within the system, the civil service, a break on par, doesn't seem to have been functioning in many of these cases.
Yeah, and I'm left with the question, what over all of those years where they were acting like this, both the political parties and the civil servants, what were they hiding from the people? Every time they looked at each other and whether verbally or just with a nod and a wink said, let's not write this down, what were they hiding? And that's why this is so important. Sam, thank you very much indeed. Thank you, sir. That's the political editor of the newsletter, Sam McBride.